Well, thank you all for coming. My name is Healy Jones, and I survived an attack by Apple. On June 6th, 2011, Steve Jobs announced the introduction of iCloud, which directly competes with my startup's offering. My company's OfficeDrop, we're a cloud storage provider, and the majority of our users are on iOS and Mac devices. So media immediately predicted the demise of my entire industry. The New York Times went as far as to say, maybe Apple will kill them all. We got calls from many analysts asking when we'd be put out of business, when Dropbox would be put out of business, when Box.net would die. And of course, you know, in the office, we may have had a little bit of panic. And you know, you have that few moments of a worst case scenario going through your head when you're watching the live broadcast of the Apple convention. But guess what? We actually grew through it. You can see when iCloud was announced, and now our user base is well over 100,000 users. In fact, our growth post iCloud announcement has been pretty phenomenal. So, you know, the big company, the big Goliath, did not kill us. It actually made us stronger, and I believe it actually helped the entire startup industry in our space. So today what we're going to talk about is David versus Goliath and a number of really powerful strategies that small businesses and startups have used when they've been directly challenged by major incumbents. If any of you would like to tweet, I'm going to suggest the hashtag SMB Goliath, all one word. And we have a couple people in the audience who are going to be helping me monitoring Twitter, so we can take questions from Twitter if you want.
What's your Twitter?
And my Twitter is Healy Hoops. It was a basketball nickname. It was not a compliment. So what we're going to talk about is software, beer, and airlines. Unlike this photo, not all at once. But we're going to just quickly talk a little bit about what it means to be a David. Look at some case studies of very successful small businesses, some startups that have really kicked Goliath's butt. But, of course, we need to look at the flip side. There are a number of instances where Goliath has completely destroyed small competitors. And so, you know, we need to be realistic, and we need to look at cases where that has happened. I'm going to give you very tactical tips that OfficeDrop has learned as we fight against very large competitors, things that have really, really worked for us. And then we'll take some questions. So I would assume that most of the people in this room are probably Davids. You are probably a small company. You're probably a startup. And you're most likely either attempting to disrupt a large existing industry, because that makes sense, that's where the money is, or you're doing something entirely new and you're creating a new space. But regardless, at some point, if you get successful enough, a large company is going to notice and they're going to want a piece of it. They're probably going to want to own that industry. Now, there may also be some Goliaths in the room. We can spot them by their very short shorts, which is pretty cold. I'm not sure why they're wearing something that short today. But what we'd also like to do is we'd like to do an interactive survey. So this is a little bit of an experiment. This has worked in our labs, so let's hope this works here. So we'd like to kind of ask what you think the scariest Goliath is. There's two ways you can participate in this survey. You can actually tweet or you can text. So we've got five of the potentially scariest large companies in the internet space. Apple, obviously, with their major device penetration. Google, who seems to be able to launch all sorts of new things and give them away. Facebook, who's about to go public. Microsoft, who's sort of the perennial big scary company. And Amazon, who's doing amazing things both with devices and with sort of cloud infrastructure. So the way that this works is you can either text to 22333, so that's two twos and then three threes, and then any of the codes that you see here for the different companies, or you can tweet at poll and then just submit one of these codes. And theoretically, this should automatically tabulate who in the art, like which of these companies we collectively believe is the scariest Goliath in the internet space. No, it's yes, there is. Yes, please. Cool. All right, well, people are starting to do this. It's working. Excellent. So I'm just going to give you a few more seconds to look at the codes on here. And what we'll do is we'll come back to this towards the end of the presentation and look in aggregate and see which companies people are thinking are most scary. So I'm going to move on. Hopefully you've started to key everything in. So I think the this key this section here is really key. It's showing examples of when David has defeated Goliath. So when a new small company has kicked a big company's butt. And the very first example is extremely classic example in the software industry, Siebel versus Salesforce. In 2001, Siebel was a behemoth. Siebel had $2 billion in revenue. Salesforce was a new startup focused on the same industry, CRM tools. Salesforce had only $5 million in revenue. So this chart is actually not drawn to scale in terms of revenue. Salesforce would not even really show up because the $2 billion is so large in comparison. And Siebel basically denied the existence of Salesforce for a few years. Now, Siebel was set up to sell their software in very large chunks, so $250,000, $2 million installs that were then put onto their clients' servers in the clients' data centers. Salesforce was one of the pioneers in what we now call SaaS, so they were not installing software anywhere. They were actually hosting it on their own. And it was at a much lower price point, and it was sold on a subscription basis. So instead of $2 million, it was $50 a seat per month. So actually substantially lower cost of ownership initially. And Siebel didn't really pay much attention to Salesforce for a while until 2003, when Goliath awoke. And Siebel could no longer deny the fact that Salesforce was growing aggressively. At this point, Salesforce had about $54 million in revenue. And Siebel was hearing from their customers that they wanted to purchase software in an on-demand or SaaS way. So Siebel launches SiebelNet, which is an on-demand solution, an attempt to offer a SaaS solution. But guess what? They completely failed. Siebel continued to shrink and was eventually purchased by Oracle. So in 2010, Oracle's on-demand, which is mainly Siebel, has about $775 million in revenue, whereas Salesforce has $1.7 billion. So Salesforce has completely kicked Siebel's butt in the on-demand space, despite the fact that the CEO of Oracle said, we are going to win. We have hundreds of engineers on this project. So the question is, why was Salesforce able to beat this massive Goliath that put them directly in their sights? And it has to do with cows, cash cows in particular. Siebel's business model was set up to sell multi-million dollar software deals. Their sales team was set up to make massive commissions selling these huge deals, these installed packages. There is no way that their distribution and their sales team would ever decide to, instead of having a $2 million sale, do maybe $200 or $300 a month sale, which is what the on-demand pricing was. It just didn't work for the commissions. It didn't work for the cash flow that was very addictive to Siebel. They would get these huge upfront revenues. It was all cash. They were not built to take their revenue and spread it out over time. So the key takeaway is that if Goliath has a cash cow, they are very slow to try to turn that into hamburger. And so as a startup, you don't have this legacy cash cow. Maybe you're really lucky to, but most startups do not have a cash cow. So you have nothing to kill. So it's fine for you to go out and kill Goliath's cash cow. Because Goliath will be very slow to react and slow to innovate in a way that destroys how they're generating their cash, you can use that to your advantage. Another very interesting technique that we've seen employed by other startups is to actually turn the major company's strength into a weakness. In business school, it's called a jiu-jitsu move. But since we're going to be talking about beer in this case, we're not going to mix martial arts with it anymore. So in 1994, the United States beer industry was completely dominated by the large brewers, the Millers, the Budweisers, the Busches, the Coors. In fact, there was no independent brewery that had anything even close to 0.5% market share in the U.S. All the independent breweries had either gone out of business in the 70s or been acquired. There was no one challenging these very large companies who were pushing mainly light beer. Until a slightly crazy guy whose grandfather was a brewer decided to start making beer in his kitchen in Boston. And he couldn't actually figure out how to sell into the convenience stores because the large brewers had all the distribution locked up. So he went bar to bar to bar to bar to bar and convinced individual bartenders to try his beer. And then because many of them liked it, they started selling it. But he was having a major problem with distribution because the large brewers had locked up distribution, and it was a major strength. They were designed to brew beer very efficiently and very cheaply move it through their supply chain. So it would be brewed at a large brewery, stored in the warehouse, moved to a distributor's warehouse, often an independent distributor who had a one-to-one relationship with that brewery in a particular territory. And then it would be moved on to trucks, and then eventually got into convenience stores and bars and restaurants. It was complete. The whole system was designed to move the beer very cheaply. And the consumers liked the cheap beer. That's what they were taught to like. So the thing that Jim Cook did that was pretty amazing was he was the first guy to put a born-on date on his beer. Because he was the only guy in Boston who could get beer from the brewery to the convenience store in a week. The big brewers would take months. And consumers noticed this, and then they started to question, hey, when was this other beer made? And when they realized it was made 5 or 6 months prior, they started to question the freshness and the taste of the beer that they were purchasing so cheaply. So what Sam Adams was able to do was completely change the conversation and turn a strength of the big brewers, which was the distribution, into a weakness, because there was no way that they could actually change their distribution model in a quick manner. Now, the big companies, of course, did react. And actually, these are all quote-unquote craft brands owned by Miller. And some of these beers are pretty good, to be honest, like Leinenkugel is a Midwestern brew that's quite tasty, for example. And you would think that if these large companies were using the power of their distribution marketing to make different, more craft-style beers, it would hurt Sam Adams. But it hasn't. In fact, Sam Adams now has 1% market share in the United States, which may not seem like a lot, but it is by far the largest independent brewery in the United States of America. And in the first 8 months, Jim Cook sold more beer than his business model predicted he would sell in the sixth year. He was extremely successful. And he attributes a lot of this to the fact that he was able to get beer very freshly into his customers' hands. So because the big breweries were unable to change and because they had set up this major strength, he was just brilliantly able to turn that into a weakness. And so large companies do have these strengths that, if you can find a way to target them, can be weaknesses because they can't change. So another key feature of Goliath is that these large companies have been around for a long time. They've been competing for many years. So you can actually see how they typically react in a competitive situation, and then you can think ahead and prepare your own response. So does anybody in here remember TED? The joke in the airline industry was that it was United without you and I. But basically, United had to react to Southwest, and they came up with their own low-cost airline. All they did was they took their existing planes, changed the logo, and pulled the first class out. There was actually nothing low-cost about it. It was just a marketing makeover. But you know, why did they need to react to Southwest? Well, Southwest built their entire business model to prepare for the reaction that would occur by the incumbents when they entered new routes. So Southwest's principal advantage was low cost. And in fact, on certain routes, Southwest had a 70% cost advantage. So their costs were up to 70% lower flying from one point to another point versus the legacy carriers. Southwest's entire business model was built to be low cost because they knew how the incumbents reacted in a competitive situation. So the incumbent airlines always fought the same way. If a new carrier entered a particular route, it was a fight to the death. It was a price war. The large carriers like United would lower their prices to the point that the small carrier went out of business. The large carriers were willing to lose money on particular routes, knowing that they could push the small company out of business after 6 months to a year. But guess what? Southwest did not lose money in these price wars. Southwest continued to be profitable. It was the incumbents that lost money, and they started to bleed as Southwest grew. So this next chart is a little bit of an eye chart, but this is actually done in, this is a report, this is from a report that was done in the 90s by the U.S. Department of Transportation. Basically, the U.S. government was concerned about the health of the airline industry in the United States and was trying to figure out what was going on. Eventually, they realized it was the Southwest effect. So I'm going to kind of, well, I'll walk you through this chart. So this blue line is the average price per seat from a flight from Oakland, California, so Northern California, to a variety of Southern California airports, mainly in the Orange County and Los Angeles area. In 89, it was about $100 a seat. As soon as Southwest entered the market, it dropped to about $50 a seat, and it stayed there sustainably for the next decade. Now, the price drops when the incumbent airlines start to fight a price war. And of course, Southwest can match the price and even beat it because they have such lower costs. The other thing that Southwest does at the exact same time is they begin to flood those routes with as many planes as they can. So the red line is actually the number of seats. So number of, basically, you can think of it as the number of flights from Northern California to Southern California in any given year. And it grows by over 3 times. So what Southwest does is they know the incumbents are going to drop prices, so they prepare their business model for that, and then they flood the market with seats, taking market share. So there's no way for the incumbents to react because they can't compete on price, and now they don't have a monopoly in the number of flights that are on these particular routes. The thing that I think is really brilliant about this is that they were really the first new startup airline to win, and they did it because they built their entire business to be low cost under the realization that they would always be fighting price wars with the incumbents on any time they entered a new route. Because they knew what the incumbents were going to do, because the incumbents had been around for so long, they built their business model to win. And as a startup, and if you know a large company is going to enter your market, you can look and see what they've done before and prepare your business model, your marketing, your product to deal with that. Another major advantage that I have found being at a startup fighting in a space with larger companies is that a small startup can actually be very close to the customers. And customers really like working with the smaller company. It's really exciting to talk with customers on the phone or to individually interact with them over email. They're very passionate about trying something new. They really like it. And they really like the fact that you're the underdog. A very classic example in the software industry of an underdog beating a behemoth is Intuit versus Microsoft. So these are Intuit is the number one financial software company, focusing first on homes and household cash management. So they had a product in the that they launched in the 80s, and it really grew in the 90s, called Quicken, that helped homeowners and individuals manage their cash flow. And then they spread into tax and other software. In 1991, Microsoft had $1.8 billion in revenue, whereas Intuit had about $50 million in revenue. And in 1991, Bill Gates noticed that, hey, this financial software space is taking off. We want a piece of that. And so Microsoft launched a product called Microsoft Money that was designed to directly compete with Quicken. Now, you need to remember that in the 90s, Microsoft was the evil empire. This was the scariest technology company on the planet. They had defeated Netscape. It looked like they were about to put Apple out of business. WordPerfect had been crushed. And they were constantly being investigated or sued on antitrust grounds. So this is actually Bill Gates testifying before Congress on an antitrust hearing. But a funny thing happens. Microsoft loses to Intuit. It took about 2 decades. But Microsoft eventually conceded the financial software market. They were unable to generate, they were unable to create anything large. And the amazing thing here is that Intuit is today a $17 billion company. So this is actually a real space. It's a real software vertical. But the behemoth, the Goliath, was unable to beat the startup. The founder of Intuit's name is Scott Cook, and he actually has written a pretty interesting book about his fight with Microsoft. And the number one reason that he attributes his success is actually his intense focus on the customers. And he did some things that were a little bit unprecedented at the time. He had his developers taking customer service calls. He took customer service calls as well. He wanted to hear the voice of the customer. He wanted his developers to understand exactly what the customer was doing, where they were having problems, what they were trying to solve with the software purchase. He also did something that maybe sounds a little creepy. He had developers hang out in technology stores and follow customers home who had purchased the software and watch them install it and set it up. There's two weird things here. First of all, letting developers out in sunlight. And then secondly, letting them go into someone's home. But it really worked. It really helped the developers understand how they had to create an intuitive software that was easy to set up, and it helped them understand specifically the problems that the customers were trying to solve, because immediately after they installed the software, they would start to try to solve a particular problem. So Scott Cook attributes his success to understanding the customers and being closer to the customers, and the fact that his customers actually wanted him as an underdog to succeed. So as startups, we can take advantage of that. We can take advantage of our ability to one-to-one interact with customers and the passion that the customers will have for working with someone who's trying to do something new. Another very successful strategy for startups when they're being attacked by large players is to find a niche. Now, this guy is certainly a little crazy, but he still sells out concerts. A long time ago, he realized he couldn't compete with Michael Jackson, so he started making fun of Michael Jackson, and it ended up being quite successful. But a more serious example is this. Does anyone remember this Business Week cover story? What Amazon fears most? Diapers. Diapers.com was an internet startup that focused on one specific vertical, the new parent vertical. And as someone who's got a 5.5-month-old, I can tell you when you're running low on diapers, it gets pretty stressful. Diapers.com was set up specifically to be able to efficiently deliver baby care products to new parents. Their entire distribution and website and customer service was set up understanding and focusing on just this one vertical. And it ended up being quite successful. Shortly after that cover story came out, Amazon announced that they were going to acquire Diapers.com for $500 million. So my particular battle with the large Goliaths is in the cloud storage or online storage space. And it's actually an industry that's starting to get a lot of press, so it's pretty fun to be in it. But on one side, there are companies that you may still call them startups, but they've been growing so well. There's a Box.net and Dropbox, and then my company, OfficeDrop. On the other side are these huge players. Microsoft has something called SkyDrive, which directly competes with us. Apple's iCloud is also a direct competitor. Google currently has Google Docs and is continuously rumored to be coming out with G Drive, which would be an online storage solution that would directly compete with us. So you'd think that the companies on the left here, the smaller companies, would be completely screwed by some of the largest players in the internet space. But we're actually all doing quite well. And I attribute this to, first of all, we have no legacy baloney. There's nothing that we have to integrate with that was built in the 90s. Everything that we are building is built from scratch to solve exactly one problem. And that makes it a lot easier to do it right. We also have no hidden agendas. We're not trying to push any particular OS. We're not trying to push Office. We're not trying to push any particular devices. There's no advertising dollars that we're trying to get. All we're trying to do is create online storage and sell it profitably. And so this focus is really, I think, quite powerful for a startup. It's actually very relieving. We don't have to worry about all sorts of other things and how it may impact our existing business when we make a change or some other business line when we make a change. It's just us. And the one thing that we're doing that I think is a little different that's been very successful for us is we partner with large companies to distribute our products. So OfficeDrop offers a white label online cloud storage offering that large companies can put their brand on and then distribute through their channel. So the first example of this is with a company called Nuance Communications. Nuance is known for Dragon speech recognition and they power Siri on the iPhone. They have an imaging division that has a very well-distributed product called Paperport. We power Paperport Anywhere, which is the cloud storage offering, and they have been distributing this thing like crazy. It's really helping us. So having a larger company working with us, fighting against these other large companies is extremely helpful because they understand how to compete against multi-billion dollar corporations. And in May this year, we'll be announcing another partnership with one of the largest technology companies in the world. And in very short order, we'll be shipping with somewhere between 10 and 20 million devices globally. So large companies, if you can align your motivation and you can respect their brand and help them offer something that is what their customers are asking for, can really help you in a competitive marketplace when you're fighting against large businesses. So unfortunately, large companies like Goliath do win, and they they win a fair amount of the time. So the question is, you know, what can we learn from times that Goliath has beaten David? But first, let's look at the survey. Let's load up a poll, see what people think is the scariest. Yeah, it seems like Google is the clear winner in terms of the scariest internet Goliath. I guess I would agree with that. I find that the pricing strategy is free is a little scary, in particular because they seem to educate the market with a substandard product and then leave the market kind of scorching the earth and then having all potential future customers think, Google didn't do a good job. I'm not going to try somebody else. So I would agree with that. I'm also scared of Google. So who can remember what the number one MP3 player was in 2001? I actually don't know. There's no, you know. Yeah, I think it was Creative. Yeah, it might have been Samsung as well. Do you have any ideas?
I was thinking IntelliDJ.
Yeah, I mean, but the point is, it doesn't matter, right? Because of iPod, Apple completely dominated this market because they had a beautifully designed product. It was just a better product in general, and then they were able to leverage their phenomenal marketing and distribution. And I think the real takeaway here is if you actually, like, I remember the Dell DJ pretty well. If you remember what these things looked like, they weren't well designed. It was more of like a techie type of a thing. They were little bricks. They were pretty ugly. Their UI sucked. And then Apple completely changed everything with a product that was actually really beautiful. So it's not just about the technology. And as a startup person, you can really get into the tech. It's about focusing on the customer and offering the right product for the customer. Another example of where Goliath is actually starting to really kick some butt is the Chrome versus Firefox. And I actually heard last night that Chrome has overtaken Firefox last month in terms of usage. I don't know if that's sure. I was at a bar, so that's my source. But I do know that this is true. My source here is Net Applications. So Firefox has been plummeting in market share ever since Chrome came out. There are a couple of key takeaways from this. One is that I think Firefox was designed as a product that was meant to appeal to geeks, and Chrome came out and out-geeked them. Secondly, I feel that Mozilla is starting to act more like an incumbent with incremental updates, whereas Chrome completely changed the game because they had no legacy whatever. They could come out with something new and fresh, and I feel like Firefox is being unwilling to slash what they currently have and come out with the thing that is completely revolutionary like Chrome. And then finally, Goliaths can be very, 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 very patient. And an example that I think we see playing out right now is in the video game console market, where Nintendo changed the game in 2007 with the Wii. And for several years, the Nintendo Wii had over 50% market share. It was completely clobbering Xbox and PlayStation. But a couple of years ago, when Xbox Kinect came out, they started to regain market share. And so Xbox Kinect basically took the concept pioneered by the Wii to the next level. Microsoft had 42% market share in January of this year, whereas the Wii has dipped, I believe, below 20%. Now, there's a chance that Nintendo will be able to respond, but you have to remember that Goliath's business was Xbox. It wasn't going to go away. They were going to fight, and they were going to come out with something again. So if you're a small company, you've got to iterate fast. You can't just rest on your laurels because you won one battle. It's going to be a very, very long game with the Goliaths. So we have learned a lot in a crowded market, and I want to share some of the very tactical things that are working for OfficeDrop as we compete against large companies. This is the obligatory South by Southwest cheetah photo. But we have to release fast, and we do. So Microsoft SkyDrive had, I believe, 3 major updates last year. We had close to 20 major updates, and we had another 24 minor updates. We're just fast. We try new things, and we release very quickly. As a small startup, you can push stuff fast. You can be faster than the big boys. There's the amount of time that it probably takes for one of these large, actually, I know from working with large companies, the amount of time that just the marketing plan takes is longer than it takes for us to conceive of a new feature, develop it, QA it, prepare marketing, and release it. So as a small company, you can be fast. So the other another thing that we have done is we have been in this business for a little while, and we've been able to we knew where the puck was going, and in particular around marketing, we knew that the large companies were going to come out with cloud offerings. So one of the things we did several years ago is we staked out very important SEO terms around the term cloud, because we knew that at some point the large companies were going to come in with marketing dollars around cloud storage, and we wanted to benefit from that. So specifically, when Microsoft came out with their To the Cloud campaign, our search traffic for cloud-related terms tripled, and we could see exactly when the exactly when their marketing dollars started being spent. We were positively impacted, and that's because we had the number, generally number one through number five spots for most cloud terms that they were advertising against. They spent $100 million in 6 months on this campaign, and we benefited from it. And in particular, their slogan was To the Cloud, and because we had good SEO juice around cloud, I was able to make a page that ranked number three for To the Cloud. And people came to that because they were curious to see what other offerings were out there. Microsoft had educated them to the idea of cloud storage, and they wanted to see what other companies might actually be offering cloud storage. Our ability to focus is also quite phenomenal. So large companies have competing priorities, and there are limited resources both at startups and large companies. And I think a lot of startups feel that they should be worried about the number of developers or resources that a large company can deploy. But what you have to remember is, sure, we may only be 20 people at my company, but all 20 of us have been working on the same thing since the day they joined the company. Whereas the large companies have competing political agendas, and someone may be the lead developer on this project and get moved off of it very quickly. There's a lot of institutional knowledge that you can keep by being so focused that the large companies don't have as their resources get moved around. And then secondly, because we're only focusing on one product, we don't have to worry again about integrating with other stuff. We're just doing what we're doing, and we're doing it as the best we can. We also really, as a small company, have to respect our customers, because unlike Microsoft, we don't have a billion of them. So we listen as carefully as we can to them, and we respond very quickly, and we respond by changing the product. And customers really, really appreciate the fact that they can call us and have a conversation with us, and then a month or two later actually see an improvement in the product live, something that they had asked for. That can't possibly happen at a large company. It just takes too long. And then finally, the partnerships that we're getting with these large companies, how they're distributing our product, particularly under their brand, is really, really a phenomenal way for a small company to grow. A large company is probably not willing to do an OEM deal or to give major economics up to another large company. But as a small business, that's actually a major advantage that you have. And these large companies know how to fight each other very effectively and do have millions of dollars to spend in marketing budgets that a startup like ours does not have. The one thing that is a theme that I have not hit on enough in this presentation is the importance of product. It doesn't really matter. None of the tactics I've discussed matter if your product isn't there. So having a really great product is probably the most important underlying theme that I didn't mention. So please don't forget product. You know, Southwest didn't just win because they were cheaper. They won because people liked flying it. Sam Adams is so successful because people like the taste of the beer. So don't forget about the importance of the great product. I think that any small company, if you start to be successful, will attract the attention of a large Goliath. Somebody big is going to want a piece of what you're doing. It can be very scary, but I'm completely convinced that if you're prepared for the entrance of large companies and you actually welcome it as a sign that, hey, I am picking a market that is really good, you can win. You can beat big companies up. There are many, many startups who have kicked big companies to the curb. There's no reason why the people in this room can't have small businesses that turn into big ones. Are there any questions? Yes.
Is there any tactics you can use to delay the time it takes to be noticed by some of your bigger competitors?
OK. Okay.
Anything you can do to stay under the radar, out of their view, you give yourself more time to build market share.
Okay. So I'm just going to repeat the question because it's being recorded. So so the question is there anything you can do to delay the notice of the large Goliaths as to your product and what you're doing? I mean, so I mean, there certainly are. One of the popular ways in the Valley, of course, is the stealth, right? But you really want to be out in the market and starting to get some attention. I think the natural problem that you're going to have is if you're starting to grow, people are going to notice. So I would probably suggest that no, it's actually really hard to do that. I think that that's unfortunately one of the benefits of being successful is that people are going to start to notice. So. Yeah. Yes. are there any Twitter questions? Got a couple friends here checking Twitter.
Yes. How can I scale my business and focus on customers at the same time?
Okay. So the question is, how can you scale and focus on customers, which is something that we are struggling with, but I think we're starting to do a pretty good job with it. So we are... When we had 7,000 customers in December of 2010, it was very different than having 100,000, which is what we've recently crossed. And we can't afford to scale our customer service in the same kind of a way. So we are using technology to leverage our customer support assets. One of the things that we're doing that people really seem to like are community forums. Because we have a number of users of our product who are really passionate about it, they are excited and willing to share their knowledge with other customers. So the community forums are becoming really successful for us. We've had a lot of luck with automated help support systems. So people seem to be willing to go to a search box and type in what they're looking for and find answers. And then the other thing that we found that's been quite successful is when we have a button where you can email support questions in. We actually have fields that people drop down, and they pre-populate the questions that we're going to ask them after they send the email, sort of like, what OS are you on, for example. Like, we always have to know what OS someone is using. But if we can get someone to tell us that in the very first contact, instead of us having to respond and ask it and then wait for them to get back to us, we can be a lot more efficient. So leveraging technology seems to be pretty effective for us right now. We should talk in a year. Hopefully it will continue to work, and we'll still have happy customers. Any other questions?
There's one more Twitter question.
Twitter question? Okay.
How would you recommend a startup approach a larger vendor to OEM its products?
Okay, so the question is, how would you recommend that a startup approach a larger vendor to OEM its products? So this is definitely seems to be a relationship sale for us. So we try to figure out who within an organization, a large organization, would be the person who would be most likely to want to offer a private labeled storage product. And then we have to find the best way to approach them and then develop a dialogue and a relationship. So it's really a long-term sort of tough business development sale. It seems to take 6 months or more to actually sign up these OEM vendors. But it's working for us, so it's worth the effort for us. Any other questions? Great. Well, thank you very much. I'm Healy Jones. Have a great Saturday night. Thank you.